Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein in our Fargo studio with my co-host, Ashley Thornburg. Ashley,
hello.
How are you?
I'm well.
A full show today. In the second half of our show, Matt Olien reviews a film where young adults escape reality into a gripping supernatural TV show. The movie is I Saw the TV Glow. And speaking of escapism, Ashley, you now talk about how fantasy and escapism helped one local author process a traumatic childhood.
Chris Stenson is a mild-mannered accountant by day, but he cast himself in his new novel, albeit with a bit of a twist.
Isabel is really me if I was a girl and had magic abilities.
The book is called Sins of the Mother, and it was a journey more than a few years in the making.
Well, actually, I started bits and pieces of the first book and the second book during college. When we were moving from our first house to our second house, my daughter found the manuscript that I had started. After not writing for 20 plus years, my daughter came and said, "Dad, I didn't know you were a writer. Why don't you finish this?"
And fast forward a couple of decades, and he did finish it. But he didn't do it alone. Stenson is a founding member of the Moorhead Friends Writing Group. They have an event coming up this weekend for word lovers. So has this ever happened to you? You thought maybe you had a book or a short story in you, but didn't quite know how to go from ideation to publication? The independent bookstore Words to Live By in Moorhead is hosting authors Melissa Prusy and Stephen Hopstaken, the authors of the Stoker's Wild books from Simon and Schuster. It's a wildly imaginative series where Bram Stoker and Oscar Wilde team up to hunt demons. Prusy is also a three-time Jeopardy champ and a Guinness World Record holder in 1990 for directing the world's longest live TV show. Together, they write novels and screenplays and help aspiring authors get their work out there. They'll be at the Words to Live By bookstore in Moorhead this Saturday from 11 to 6. Stenson organizes events like this because writing groups helped him get about a dozen short stories and now his novel published. Sins of the Mother is the first in the Maiden Mother Crone series. It's a dark fantasy where a young girl, Isabel, is caught between two realms as unseen forces battle for her very soul.
It is a dark fantasy based in urban realism. I mostly write horror, but this one is kind of like real life with magic.
There's a young girl in the book,
Isabel.
And she is prone to headaches and almost like fugue states. So she doesn't necessarily remember how she got to somewhere. And it leads to her being involved in some kind of scary. I don't want to be giving away the plot here, but she keeps ending up in these places, not really sure of her involvement. And it's kind of walking this line between, is she sort of psychic and knowing this, or is she causing this?
Isabel, for most of the book, thinks she's losing her mind.
Yeah.
Losing her sanity.
Right.
And really what's happening is other people are controlling her life.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the few books that you read where the good guys lose the first battle.
She ends up in a heap of trouble.
It's about a war for her soul. Who is going to win it? Is she going to take control of her soul, or is the darkness inside of her going to take over her soul?
You haven't finished this.
No.
So even you don't know what happens to Isabel's soul.
Well, it's kind of how I write too. I'm kind of more of a what they call a panster, kind of flying from the seat of my pants.
Oh, okay.
There are people who write huge outlines, and they basically just have to fill in a few transitions to make their outline work. And I probably know 5 or 6 points in the book where I want to hit.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind of let the characters take over. Sometimes I get surprised. And sometimes I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and the characters are talking to me and says, "Chris, you should probably get up and write now." For a long time, I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then that got old.
Yeah.
And then, you know, my goal is to sit down and write every day.
Okay.
You know, when I wrote the first draft, my goal was to write 350 words a day for a year, which then is roughly a 360-page book. 365 words, roughly a page in a novel.
Okay.
And, you know, most novels are in that 300 to 350 page. And so if you do that every day for a year, you've written
a novel. It's that simple. You have it. There you have it, folks.
But it's, you know, but there's some days the water flows. Mm. It's like turning on a spigot some days where the water just flows and flows. And other days it just kind of drips outward.
Yeah.
You write six paragraphs and you keep a sentence.
Yeah. Well, talk to us, Chris, about how important it is to recognize that in yourself, because so many people have an idea and then when it just doesn't go the way they've either been told the process is supposed to work or they get to that first point of being stuck and then they just kind of give up instead of learning to pivot. What have been some of the key metrics that you've put into play?
Well, I'm an accountant by trade. Mm-hmm. That's what pays the bills. And I am a lover of spreadsheets, so I track how much time I spend, how many words I write, and then I set goals.
I hate everything about this.
I set goals. So if I hit my goals, I earn so much money a month that I can use then to pay myself so I can buy more books.
Ah, okay. So there is a built-in reward system. Now that I can get behind.
Yeah, so basically if I hit my goals or go over my goals, and then I keep track monthly, daily, yearly. So I have my yearly goals, so I know how many words I need to write it a year, and I've kind of taken an average. So this is, and I keep track of it, and then I use that then to buy more books. I've been a lover of words and books for a long time. Some of the characters are based on some of my family members. And
it's a dark book.
I had a horrible stepfather. Mm. A couple of those scenes actually happened in my life.
Oh my God.
But I learned a lot from it. And actually, him and I buried the hatchet many, many, many years ago. And we talked, and he apologized, and I understood. But as a middle schooler, you don't always recognize that.
Yeah.
And I actually wrote
when you're being abused.
Yes. And it wasn't, it was more of psychological abuse. I believe physical abuse, the pain eventually goes away.
Mm.
But to me, psychological abuse doesn't go away. Because sometimes when you hear yelling and screaming, even if you're not involved in the situation, it sparks memories. And so I kind of used the book to come to grips with growing up and helped, I would say, heal.
Mm-hmm.
Because I believe that everybody needs a second chance and you have to forgive people. No matter how horrible they were in your life, you need to find a way to forgive and move forward. Because if you don't, you won't move forward.
Yeah. How long did that take you?
A long, long time. My parents divorced when I was small.
Yeah.
Going to the farm and escaping to my grandparents and my father was a way that I could escape for a couple months growing up.
Yeah. Escapism is definitely explored in a book like this because it takes place in what you could refer to as different realms. There is this sense that there are other spirits, other life forces, other, I don't know if dimensions is the right word.
Realities.
Other realities. Okay. Chris, I'm really intrigued by the fact that this book, you described it as autobiographical before we started recording. It's about a young girl who is in between different dimensions of reality. So on the surface, that doesn't sound like it could be about you. Why do you think you were so drawn to exploring it through this lens of a different sex and gender and understanding of reality and time and space?
I think, you know, to hide from the truth a little bit.
Hmm.
I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, because if I came out with myself, people would recognize that.
And
you know, Isabel is really me if I was a girl and had magic abilities.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some things as a girl that you can, that is a little different than being a guy.
Hmm.
Where you can explore some more emotions than if the character was a boy. Because if I would have made me as the character, it would have been a different exploration of the feelings that, I mean, you have growing up. I've had people ask me questions, beta readers and critiquers, but really not in-depth emotional. You know, what was I thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Why did I write the book the way I did?
Mm-hmm.
And I've been thinking about this for a long, many, many years about when it came to that day where I really had to explain the book and what was going on.
That's when you finally realized what
I couldn't hide from the fact that a lot of what happens in the book are scenes straight from my life. With a little twist, not exactly the same, but
right.
Fairly close.
But the alcoholism?
My father drank a lot. My mother, for a period of time, really, really struggled raising three kids in the 70s and 80s on her own. And I love my mom dearly.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame her for everything. There's a couple things I blame her for, but I understand. And I'm not trying to paint her in a horrible light, because my mother wasn't horrible. She just had struggles at times. She kind of like Sharon, who's Isabel's mother in the book, she has her own demons that she's running from. And we all have our own demons. And that's one of the things about my writing is I like to explore the darkness inside each person, because everybody has some darkness inside them.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody also has some light inside them. Who wins depends on, to me, your outcome in life. Those who can't overcome their demons or be disciplined tend to end up in trouble with the law.
Mm-hmm.
Or alcohol or drugs.
Yeah. Is it fair to ask, Chris, is it also an exploration of how to stay light when you're surrounded by darkness? Because Isabel, to me, never comes off as a dark character, even though she's disappearing into different realms and wakes up with, you know, blood on her at times.
I disappeared in a fantasy life at times in growing up.
Yeah.
My father, in the dedication, I dedicate the book to my father and my wife and my daughter, who are great inspirations. But my father was the one who taught me the love of words and books. And so when life was the worst, that's where I disappeared into. I would hide in my room in a corner with a book,
yeah,
and disappear into that imaginary world.
Mm.
And at times, did I stretch the truth every once in a while, talking to friends and saying what the things I could do? Yeah, I did, but it was a way to cope. Because I didn't tell a lot of people how bad life was growing up at times, or how hard it was. Because my mother didn't see a lot of it because she worked at night.
Mm.
And a lot of the things that he did, he took out on me because he was frustrated with his relationship with my mother in marriage.
Yeah.
And some of it is his life also.
Have they read the book?
My stepfather passed away a few years ago. My mother has not yet. But she says she plans to buy it this weekend and then read it. And I'm willing to guess that we will probably have some conversations.
That's author Chris Stenson about his novel Sins of the Mother. He'll be one of the authors at an upcoming book release party. It's this Saturday at the Words to Live By bookstore in Moorhead. The event is from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. and features Melissa Prusy and Stephen Hopstaken, co-authors of the Stoker's Wild series, where they imagine if Bram Stoker and Oscar Wilde teamed up to hunt demons. Stenson first interacted with them when they spoke with the Moorhead Friends Writing Group, which has about 40 writers from 13 states in Canada. They meet over Zoom or in person every other Tuesday from 7 to 9 p.m. You can find out more at moorheadfriendswritinggroup.com. Stenson was doing some fundraising for the library when the director, Megan Kruger, encouraged him to do a little more, including some networking.
So she said, you know, do you want to start a group? And I said, sure.
Very confidently, I can tell.
Because I had no idea. I was part of another online writers group at the time, but I said, sure, I'll look into it. So I did what everybody does, and you use Google. I Googled how to start a writers group. And I found
half
one
of adulting is just Googling things.
And I found a great group that had some really good things written down about how to run a writer's group, things you can do. So I printed that out, set up the meeting at the library, and five people showed up. We started talking about, so what do we want to accomplish? Started off by having writing prompts and reading each other's work. And then we slowly grew. I mean, you know, five at a time or a couple at a time. And then COVID hit.
Yep.
And to me, that was actually the turning point in the writers group. We turned to Zoom. And for 2 years, we just met over Zoom. But because of that, our social media presence grew. And we kept adding members. Some of the members that I was with this other writers group, I invited to ours. And they become really important to the group. My novel signed with an indie publishing company. In 2021, I signed a publishing contract for my book. When I got that email at work that day, I was just ecstatic that, wow. Because my goal always has been to sign a traditional publishing contract.
Yeah.
That's been my goal since third grade.
Mm-hmm.
However, it did not go well. The company ended up having some issues.
Mm.
Luckily for us, a very, very good attorney was the author that took the brunt of what was going on, and he wrote the letter that got us all our rights back. But it was really a waste of a year on Sins of the Mother, because. Mm. My editor kept asking questions, but we never got any place. It was like they were stalling. But the good thing was, is during that time, I started writing short stories because I hadn't wrote short stories since probably high school, college. Probably about a month after I signed my publishing contract, I signed my first short story contract. And by the end of this year, I will have published 12 short stories in different anthologies. and they're fun. I really do enjoy writing short stories. It's a challenge because I'm long-winded.
Mm-hmm.
so to get better at being precise.
If I had more time, I'd have written you a shorter letter. At this event, you have a couple of screenwriters coming and who have worked professionally, who have sold their screenplays. Let's talk about, Chris, what they'll be doing at an event like this and what it means to work with somebody who's operating on just a different level than you.
Well, Melissa Pruzzi and Stephen Hopstaken spoke to our group in 2021. What's the worst thing that can happen when you ask somebody something?
Mm-hmm.
The worst thing they can say is no.
Mm-hmm.
We've had over 60 authors now speak to the group.
Wow.
And we have some very, very high-level authors. And people say, well, how do you get them to speak to your group, especially from Moorhead, Minnesota? And I said, I ask. I do the same pitch. I use the same pitch every time that I approach one. I send them the message, and they either say yes or they say no. Last year, I think I sent out 14 messages to get 12 writers to speak to us.
That's a heck of a return on investment.
And I've got to meet some of these authors. And one of them, Dacre Stoker, the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker.
Okay.
He was our first speaker. I reach out and try to get to know people because really what we're trying to do is get exposure to the Moorhead Friends Writers Group and to our writers. Because we do have writers who are good enough to sign agent contracts, to sign big contracts. It is just, we need to meet more people and we need to be at the right spot at the right time. Because really,
you
know, a lot of
in that room.
A lot of it is being lucky. I hate to say that, but sometimes you have to make your own luck, but mm-hmm. to being lucky. One of our authors, who's a best-selling New York Times author, spoke to us a couple months ago, and she said she found her agent at the second writer's group that she ever went to.
Oh, wow.
She turned in a chapter. There was a member of the group who did not tell anybody that they were an agent. And the agent loved her work, signed her, and she's written 18 to 20 books since then.
Okay.
I mean, I kind of asked, do we have any agents in our group? That
Someone, anyone?
And so on Saturday, June 22nd, we are having a book release party for our third anthology with special guests Melissa and Stephen at the Words to Live By bookstore in Moorhead, Minnesota. They carry mostly used books, but high-quality used books. She believes in quality.
How do you describe the role of an independent bookstore in a neighborhood?
Oh, I think besides a library, they're kind of the heartbeat of neighborhoods, at least in my world. In my world of words and books, indie bookstores are a must. And have a bookstore like Jill who believes in local writers, supporting local writers. You know, she does carry all of the books of the Moorhead Friends Writers Group, but she also then promotes our group. And there's been many authors who have asked her to sell their books, and she's convinced that they should join our group. Every author needs to have a bookstore. Amazon is great, but you really need a place where a person can come and pick up your book and feel it.
Yeah.
And smell it.
Chris Stenson, author of Sins of the Mother. He runs the Moorhead Friends Writing Group, which has authors from 13 states and Canada. They read each other's work and hear from nationally known authors to get their work out. Find out more at moorheadfriendswritinggroup.com. Chris helped organize a book signing and author talk coming this Saturday at the Words to Live By bookstore in Moorhead. Begins at 11 a.m. and runs until 6.
They meet every other Tuesday in person or over Zoom. The next speaking event is July 2nd. Still to come on Main Street, news director Dave Thompson and a movie review from Madeline. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. Introducing the recipients of the 2024 Bush Fellowship. Learn more about the 2024 fellows at bushfoundation.org/fellows.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody, I'm gonna tell you a story.
And speaking of stories, it's time for us to reflect on this week's news in North Dakota with our longtime news director, Dave Thompson, here at Prairie Public. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing fine, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Dave. I want to start off with a story that you talked about last week, now that you've written, and it questions whether North Dakota political conventions are still a thing, essentially. What did you learn?
Well, I talked to a UND professor, Mark Jendrisik. He talked about that with the continuing, the continuing tradition of candidates actually financing their own campaigns, conventions as an endorsing tool probably are becoming less and less relevant unless some major changes are made. Now, I've followed up a little bit with some people, and they said that there might be some legislation to basically do away with endorsing conventions and just have everything go to the primary because a lot of people are financing their own campaigns that way.
Did you have a feel for how much influence, if any, recommendations or endorsements had in this past primary election?
When Kelly Armstrong got the endorsement for governor, he was unopposed at the convention. Tammy Miller had every intent to go right to the primary, as Doug Burgum did when he ran against Wayne Stengem for the Republican endorsement. He just skipped the endorsing convention altogether, as did Tammy Miller. And the other candidates that were endorsed by the Republican Party or given a letter of support did not fare very well, and they're not on the ballot right now.
Dave, we also talked last week about an insurance study, and now the budget section of the legislature has given the insurance commissioner the go-ahead to spend $1.5 million to study how to improve North Dakota's insurance market.
Well, as we talked about, insurance rates are going up, and the insurance department's getting a lot of calls from people saying, why are my housing insurance rates going up, or why are my car insurance rates going up? And he said it really is kind of a national problem, and maybe North Dakota can get out front of it. Now, the $1.5 million is going to come from fees that insurance companies pay directly to the insurance department. The insurance department is not a general fund agency. It doesn't receive state general funding. It gets the funding from the insurance companies. So they're going to take it from that. But they still have to go before legislators to get that approved, because legislators do talk about spending, no matter whether it's general funds or special funds. And there were a few objections to it because they thought it maybe just should be kicked into an interim study by the legislature. When John Gottfried appeared before the budget section, he said, yeah, but this is a problem that we need to get solved quickly instead of waiting until 2027. They believe it is a serious enough problem that they're worried, for example, if they don't get, you know, some kind of standard about building permits and things like that across the state, that insurance companies are going to be less likely to write insurance plans in North Dakota. They don't want that to happen.
And there are some states where it's next to impossible to get insurance for your house, for
example. That is correct.
Dave, the gas-to-oil ratio has been chatted about in the Bakken oil wells here recently. In fact, that ratio, gas-to-oil, has increased. What's the latest?
Now, I'll go back a little bit, Craig, when I first learned about this when we were covering the Bakken, that the Bakken geology says as oil production declines, natural gas production goes up. So it's kind of not exactly what you would think. You'd think if oil went down, gas would go down too, but no, actually gas goes up. And now they're looking for a way to, you know, keep that capture rate at least at 95%. To do that, you need pipelines. To do that, you need places for the gas to go. So there is a real interesting talk about that, because there is a need for more gas plants. There might be a few on the drawing board to get natural gas processed and get it to market, and then have a way to get natural gas liquids out of the Bakken and where they're used. One thing that natural gas is going to be used for is in the Wahpeton area. They're taking this thing off the Northern Border Pipeline. WBI has a compressor station at Mapleton. Then they're going to go south, and it will serve Kindred and Wahpeton. And that's a big deal, because it means more natural gas possibilities and natural gas that is available for businesses, for homes in that area.
Dave, $72.6 million was approved by the State Water Commission for a whole slew of projects.
Right. And you see what the projects are. There's some clean water projects. There's some water supply projects. And it was a pretty good chunk of change that was approved by the North Dakota Water Commission. But of course, in the whole funding of oil taxes, part of that does go to water. So, you know, the money was available and there are some projects that are waiting out there and they wanted to get those done.
There's a property tax measure that could cost the state about $1.3 billion, estimates are now showing. And Dave, this property tax measure is likely to appear on November's ballot, and this would eliminate property taxes. Now, I'm going to use an office metaphor. I like the show The Office.
Oh, sure.
Is this threat level midnight for budget planners and the legislature?
I would say the threat level's a little before midnight, but there's some interesting and serious concerns among local governments because that's how local governments are funded, through property taxes. So they worry about loss of local control, and they worry about having to go to the legislature every 2 years with their hands out. And I've heard that from county commissioners, city commissioners, and representatives of group who have established now, you know, a keep it local coalition to try to fight the measure. They say, yeah, we think it's going on the ballot, but we need to get this fought at the ballot box, and we need to convince voters that the best control is local control. And how do you have local control over what happens in your local governments is by doing it through property taxes. There, in the measure, Craig, there is no revenue stream to replace property taxes, and that would be up to the legislature.
So in the side halls of the legislature, Dave, are people worried that people are going to look at this and say, shoot, yeah, I don't want to pay property taxes. I'm voting for this.
Yeah. There's a real concern about property taxes, that property taxes seem to be, you know, going up and up and up. There are other solutions that are out there, and that's what the backers of this coalition say. You know, this is not the right solution because you have to go to the legislature all the time, and yeah, we've got the money right now, but what happens in a downturn?
Dave, I was approached by a person soliciting signatures for the marijuana question to be on the ballot. This gentleman was very confident that they were going to have success as he was talking to me.
Yes, talking to the organizers, they say they will have the required amount of signatures plus some holdover to make sure that signatures are valid, to make sure that it will be on the ballot. I think it is going to be on the ballot. And there were a couple of interesting anecdotes about that, Craig. Number one, I found out, and I should have realized this, they had petitions on the Moorhead side, you know, the Fargo-Moorhead area.
Sure.
But as long as you could prove you're a North Dakota voter, you could sign the petition in Moorhead. I find that kind of interesting. And yeah, that makes sense, but you don't think about these things.
Sure. I mean, it matters where you live, not where you sign.
Right. Now, the backers of the measure are talking about a conservative choice to do it this way because they'll tax it, they'll regulate it, and they'll make sure that there are definite limits and caps on how much marijuana you can have. I don't have a real feel how it's going to go in the general election. I just don't know if North Dakota is ready for it.
North Dakota will be sandwiched now that it is becoming legal in Minnesota. It is legal in Montana, and North Dakota will be in the middle. And I would guess an argument would be, we're losing tax revenue.
That's right. We're losing tax revenue. And then we've got people who are going to Minnesota or going to Montana, buying it, bringing back to North Dakota. And the argument is, okay, let's keep that money in state.
Dave, Bismarck leaders have been working to solve, I guess, the housing affordability issue. And in fact, they've listed it as a top priority for Bismarck. But I've got to believe this is a state problem. And I'm wondering, Dave, who's working on this at the statewide level?
I can tell you that there are various task forces at the state level. And the North Dakota Housing Finance Agency has said it's one of their top concerns as well. They want people to have a roof over their head and not to spend, you know, nights outside because they can't afford housing. That's the real crisis, is the affordable housing. Do we have enough? And apparently we do not. So there are efforts underway at the state level and at local government levels to try to get affordable housing accomplished.
Dave, the primary election is now in our rearview mirror, but is there any new fallout that you've heard about that we should be concerned about?
Other than the fact that there are various complaints to law enforcement agencies and the Federal Election Commission about some of the shenanigans that happened during the election. And there's still some hard feelings that might have to be overcome. Because in the Republican Party, there were intra-party challenges at the district level for legislators. And of course, at the state level, and we talked about this, you know, the day before the election, here comes a text that Julie Fedorchuk was going to withdraw from the campaign for Congress. And what got a lot of people upset is not that was not true, but the editing on that spot. They showed a video clip from one of the local television stations. It was highly edited, and it looked like, yeah, she was withdrawing. But the clip was taken from when she pulled her name out of contention at the convention. Let's put it that way. She pulled her name out because she saw it was just a mess. So she pulled her name out and said, I'm going to the primary.
In my opinion, this is really shows us the need to make sure that you verify news and make sure it's a reputable source, I guess you should
say.
That's
right. And that's something we have to do, not only at Prairie Public, but in the news media at large. We need to maybe do a better job of telling our story that if you're looking for honest brokers of information, here we are.
Dave, what are you and your staff working on? What are we going to hear from you next week about?
Well, what you're going to hear from me next week, and it's just kind of a fun story because I have to tell a little bit about it. There's a building that's on the Capitol grounds. It had the Water Commission in it. Before that, it was the first location of Bismarck Junior College, which became Bismarck State College. Well, the Water Commission moved out several years ago because of, get this, mold. And, of course, asbestos. So they want to tear the building down, and there probably will be a move to replace it with something new, but there is a stream, an underground stream that goes under this building that had the Water Commission in it, and so they have to fill that in too, and they're going to take some of the dirt from this new state laboratory that's being built on the Capitol grounds, which is the first building built on the Capitol grounds in many years.
Dave, we'll look forward to that. It's always a great pleasure to visit with you. Hope you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you, Craig. You too.
Madeline is up with a movie review. That's next. Stay with us.
Listening to Prairie Public right now, so I bet you're a bit of a news junkie, right? But do you also like music? Well, I bet you do. Prairie Public is the place for that too. Did you know that we have a guy named Mike Olson who spins adult album alternative music during the week?
There goes the last DJ who plays what he wants to play.
He's got an endless library, limitless musical knowledge, and a clever way of handcrafting sets of songs. You can listen to Prairie Public's Roots Rock and Jazz stream on an app or a smart speaker pretty much anywhere, and on an HD radio anywhere in the region. Check out Mike Olson on Prairie Public weekdays from 9 a.m. to 10 and noon to 6 p.m.
There's the fanfare. That means it's time to go off to the movies with Matt Olean. Matt, an intriguing looking picture here called I Saw the TV Glow. Now, this is a horror, suspense, supernatural sort of film. And as I was watching the trailer, after reading a couple sentences, I was sort of prepared for, you know, shocking moments and stabbing. It feels a little bit more psychological.
It is definitely a film about queer culture and gender identification. So it offers kind of a window into this world, but doesn't necessarily ask the audience to understand it. It's just kind of a window into what's going on. So it's directed by Jane Schoenbrunn, her second feature film. She goes by they and their pronouns. I should mention that. She's a trans director, Jane Schoenbrunn. And this is their second feature. And the first one was very well received. This was a big hit at Sundance as well. And it's really directed in kind of like a low-budget experimental way. It takes place in suburbia 1996. And it's really the story of one boy named Owen, played by Justice Smith, for the most part. It starts out, he's in seventh grade, different actor plays him. And he is fascinated by a late-night show called The Pink Opaque. And he finds a ninth grader, Maddie, played by Bridget Lundy Payne, who kind of steals the movie in terms of her acting. And he kind of watches the show with her. And it's a very strange show. It's about two teenage girls. One's imaginary, one's not. There are strange monsters in the episode. So there's a lot of nods and winks to like the TV obsession of Twin Peaks, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, these kind of things, how teenagers and young adults get into these shows so much that it becomes such a huge part of their lives. And Maddie wants to be in this TV world. And at some point in the movie, you start to wonder what's real and what isn't, and where's this really going? So I really like this movie a lot. It's unlike any movie I think you're going to see this year. It's very strange, but very captivating. And it asks, you know, major questions about queer culture, gender identity, how people identify, what worlds they want to live in, what do they want to be referred to as, what name do they want to be referred to as. And it's about life decisions and the moment where you need to make a life decision of kind of going for it, which Maddie wants Owen to do. She kind of pulls him into this world without giving plot details away. There's a huge moment where he has to decide, am I going for this crazy pink opaque world that Maddie's talking about, or am I going to settle for convention?
Hmm.
And that's that we all face these moments in life, Ashley. We know people that I've known that just kind of settled for what I think they've settled for convention, you know, not going out and kind of seeing the world and doing what you have to do. And everybody has to make those decisions. We understand that, not judging here. But in this movie, it's a crucial moment where Owen has to make that decision. So, It's shot in, like I said, kind of this experimental, low-budget way. And it's not terribly frightening, but it's frightening in terms of the decisions we make in life.
Hmm.
And as I said, Bridget Lundy Payne, I think, kind of steals the movie as Maddie, who's this, you know, very outcast high school girl. There's one moment where one of her friends becomes now on the cheer team, so she's not friends with her anymore. That's not what Maddie wants to do. And we've all experienced that in high school, too, where friends separate and they go different ways and end up in different cliques. So like this movie a lot. It's strange. It's short. Seek it out. Go see it. And I think it's a film that's going to be kind of remembered at the end of the year, certainly for Independent Spirit Awards, I think, anyway. Jane Schoenbrunn, as I said, is the director. She's a trans director for sure. Wants to make some comments about queer culture, but not over the head. It's like I said, it's a window into this world, but you don't necessarily have to be part of it or understand it to kind of watch this film and enjoy it.
Where did you end up seeing this? Was this in theaters or did you stream it?
Fargo Theater.
Okay.
Fargo Theater. Mm-hmm. So it's ending, I will say, ending very soon. So please check your listings where you can go see it, but it's still out there in release.
Is there a sense of why it's called I Saw the TV Glow when that's not the name of the show? Or
So when he watches the television show, he is obsessed with it.
Mm.
So is Maddie. And there are moments where, shall we say, whether it's real or imagined, they're sucked into the TV set.
Okay.
I'll just say that. I think what the title means, Ashley, is that moment where we're obsessed with something on television or a movie or whatever. So the TV glow is kind of that glow inviting him into this world called the Pink Opaque.
Sure.
And they really do a good job editing, Ashley, the fake show called the Pink Opaque. It feels like a 90s kind of crazy show that's maybe a little campy in retrospect, but they really do a nice job of kind of editing this fake show to make it look like it's really on TV in the suburbs in 1996, 97, 98, 99. The film starts right during the Dole Clinton election of 1996, which is kind of a key plot point right away in the movie. A lot of time jumping. You have to kind of stick with it as the years go by. But strange film. Not necessarily commercial, but I liked it a lot, and I would invite people to go check it out if you want something different.
What kind of film? It's like a if you like this, then you'll like.
I would say more TV, Ashley. If you like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and if you liked Twin Peaks, I would go see this movie because it's very much about the obsession that kids, young adults mostly, have over TV shows or a movie or Star Wars or whatever, where that world becomes a more real world to them
sure.
than this boring, you know, teenage angst world that they're living
of
in.
Conformity.
That's the best way I can say it, right?
Okay, yeah. Right. You're getting the glow from that, the warm embrace of the TV.
The glow in TV that isn't in your real life. Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right, well, Oscar trivia for you. One of the film's producers, Emma Stone.
Mm-hmm.
She has been nominated a few times and won a couple of those.
She has. She won for La La Land in 2016, and this past spring became the 15th actress to win Best Actress multiple times for Poor Things, also nominated for The Favorite and Birdman.
And also a second time for Poor Things.
Oh, producer. Producer.
Yeah. And for Best Picture there.
Kinds of Kindness, starring Emma Stone in Yorgos Lanthimos' new movie, July 3rd. It will be in theaters regionally and locally.
All right. We've been to the movies with Matt Olin.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 20th. The town site of Beach was established when the Northern Pacific Railroad built a section house there in 1881. However, it wasn't until 1900 when settlement really started to happen. As with so many new towns, every new establishment or building or exhibit showed progress, was exciting, and was newsworthy. In 1910, the Golden Valley Chronicle reported on some of these new businesses and opportunities. A new state bank was being established. There was discussion that Beach might get a flax fiber twine center, which could save money for the farmer in twine bills and give him a market for flax straw. It was also imagined that such a plant would be a big thing for whatever town was home to such a plant. Under an article entitled, "We Have Streetlights Now," the paper discussed the addition of lights and how beneficial it was. In particular, in the evening after a long rain, the lighting would be important because the unpaved streets could be covered, quote, "with that peculiarly sticky mud characteristic of this region." And then, also probably helpful after a muddy evening, there was this announcement. At last, Beach is to have a modern steam laundry, something which has long been needed and which, we believe, will be easily supported. It turned out many people were getting their items laundered out of town, like in Dickinson or even Bismarck. With the right kind of laundry, the article stated, these items could be just as well cared for here at home. A building for the laundry was constructed southwest of the high school with a boiler and engine room. Advertisements noting that it was open for business filled newspapers in early 1911. By this date, that same year, the laundry had a reopening event, having been refitted and added to by a new manager, C.A. Bevier, who the paper called a practical laundryman and businessman. Some of the additions to the business were a bishop neck and wrist ironer and a new collar and cuff starcher. Machinery was also moved around to create more space to make it easier to separate the clean from the dirty. The Golden Valley Chronicle commented that the citizens of Beach may rest assured that this city will henceforth have a laundry second to none in the state. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Jonathan Merritt's road to self-acceptance as a gay man and a Christian wasn't an easy one. Now he's written a children's book he hopes will make that road easier for others. It's called My Gunkle and Me.
You write the book you wish you had as a child, and I think that's especially true for children's books.
Helping kids embrace the things that make them different on the next morning edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow in this time slot at 3 p.m. Central, we'll air The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. This week, the question of whether money is disrupting our politics is discussed. At 7 p.m. on Friday, we'll air Science Friday with host Ira Flatow. Monday on the show, with the arrival of the summer solstice, it's time for the dog days of summer. We'll have great tips to beat the heat and have summer fun with travel writer Alicia Underlee Nelson and an expert guest in summer fun, her 11-year-old son Eli. We hope you can join us again here on Main Street.